You're listening to episode 292 of Women Worldwide. Let's talk about the power of words. Are you hearing and seeing their uplifting nature, or are they words on fire? I've got a guest who has a lot to share on this topic, so stay tuned to learn more. Hi, I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. I've spent an entire career helping women to share stories, nurture relationships, grow their brands, but most of all, to find their voices so they can make a difference. Do you feel stuck? Do you want to power up your own voice? Women Worldwide features the stories of passionate women who have navigated big career challenges and some of the toughest changes. These professionals offer deep insights and advice to inspire you and to help you uncover what's holding you back. Let Women Worldwide ignite your passion so you can excel in life. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Women Worldwide. Thank you so much for tuning in and for showing up wherever you are in this world. We appreciate you. And we also can't thank you enough for all of the sharing that you're doing of our shows and letting us know how you're feeling most of all. This gets us to find the guests, the inspiration, the stories, the motivation, and the help that you need. So I want to get right to today's topic, which is words, and whether they are uplifting or they're words on fire. Now, I'm going to let you decide, because you are currently seeing and hearing plenty of words out there, whether it's on social media, in the news, at your companies, or even in your personal gatherings. And that's the segue to my special guest. Joining me on the show is Helio Fred Garcia. Fred, my friend and colleague who is returning to Women Worldwide, he is an alum. Fred is an author of several books, and we're going to talk about his new book today. He is a professor, a crisis consultant. He's also a speaker, and he is the founder of Logos Institute. And I could say so much about Fred because I admire his work, but I think it's best he shares his journey and advice with you. So Fred, welcome back to Women Worldwide.
Thank you, Deirdre. Delighted to be back.
Well, it is great to have you back, because the last time you were here, we were talking about crisis and reputation and your one of your other books. And I'd like to just start to let everybody, the Women Worldwide audience know, maybe you can share just a little bit about how you chose this journey to the power of communication and words and reputation.
Well, thank you. I guess the truthful answer is I came on that journey because I felt so powerless and helpless as a child. And that is, I'm an immigrant to the United States. I came here as a very young child. I have an unpronounceable and inaccessible name. I didn't speak English. I had a very heavy accent, and I was immediately characterized as the other. And by the time I was 10, 11 years old, I was the target of more than bullying, but I have scars on my head from when I was hit with bricks and rocks and kicked with boots. I was sexually humiliated. I was emotionally tortured. And I felt completely helpless and completely powerless. And thankfully, I had a number of very gifted teachers who figured it out, who kept me back after school for an entire year, 90 minutes a day, and taught me what I had missed in school, taught me English, put me on a path forward. By the time I finished with that particular teacher, I was the top of my class. I skipped eighth grade. I went to a very competitive high school. I joined the debating team. By the time I was 15, I was one of the debating champions in the New York City Catholic school system. And by the time I was 17, I was a page on the floor of the House of Representatives during Watergate summer.
Oh, my.
And so my path has been one of compensating for feeling helpless, and in particular, feeling helpless because I didn't have the words. I didn't have the ability to express myself. And I've been fortunate to build a career over the last 40 years where I have essentially taken on the role of those teachers of mine And that is, in all the work I do, I work to equip people to become leaders who inspire and who change the world for the better. Whether I do that in a classroom, or I do that with a client, or I do it through my writing, or I do that through my public speaking, it's about equipping people to be carriers of positive energy, using verbalized energy to change people, to change the world.
What a story. What a journey, Fred. And how grateful for the educators, you know, the teachers in your life, and for equipping you and arming you with this ability to move forward. Truly, truly inspirational. And it's true, you are someone who really does help and educate to let others know how these words matter. And this is your new book. You just wrote Words on Fire. So please tell us a little bit about this book.
One of the things, as you know, that I do is I'm a professor of ethics and leadership and communication at New York University and at Columbia University. And one of the things I do in my scholarship is I study patterns of influence and patterns of audience reaction to leaders. And I describe those patterns in my teaching and in my books. And one of the things I've noticed over the last 5 years is a pattern that I found very, very troubling. Mm-hmm. Most of the work I do is helping leaders become better leaders to inspire for the good. But I also notice when leaders are using language in ways that put people at risk. And about 5 years ago, I noticed a disturbing pattern. And that was then candidate Trump, later President Trump, was using language in ways that I recognized as the kinds of language that preceded acts of mass violence, up to and including genocide. And I began to be very concerned about that. I began to post social media around that saying, hey, someone's going to get killed if this doesn't stop. And then the Tree of Life Synagogue shooting happened. And the shooter in the Tree of Life Synagogue explicitly repeated the language that President Trump had been using in an intensified way of an invasion by funded by Jewish bankers, George Soros in particular, that was intended to displace white people with brown people. And he used that language in a social media post. He happens to be a white supremacist. And he was inspired and motivated by the president. And then he went into the synagogue and killed 11 people. The same week, we saw the mail bomber using President Trump's language against his rivals and critics, the mail bomber sent death threats to the people that President Trump had been demeaning on social media, then sent bombs. And both of those things happened in the same week, which was 10 days before the 2018 midterms.
I remember that. Fred, so you are somebody who has studied patterns. Yeah. And you can recognize, like you said, the good and words that are incendiary. So what can the average person do? How can they confront this type of language so that they don't get pulled into a negative pattern, but so that they can stay positive?
I wrote the book in order to equip people to recognize the pattern, to have the capacity to address the pattern and to confront the speakers, whether the speakers are the president of the United States or a member of a school board or the schoolyard bully.
So you can take it really into your own life and personally, locally.
But it requires recognizing the pattern. And what I do in the book is I show the forms of language. There are 12 kinds of language that historically precede acts of violence. One is to dehumanize people. Another is to demonize people. And one of the things that happens when a group of people is dehumanized or when rivals are demonized is it lessens society's capacity for empathy. And things that previously would have been not only unacceptable, but inconceivable become normalized. So let me just give an example from the book. The most powerful form of language that provokes violence is to dehumanize a group of people, to call them animals, to call them vermin, to say that their presence among us is an infestation. And in the book, I documented how that was the first play in the Nazi playbook. It was the first play in the Rwandan Hutu demeaning of the Tutsi that led ultimately to the massacre of 800,000 people in 100 days. And there, the Hutu referred to the Tutsi as cockroaches. And in Hutu ideology, it said that a cockroach cannot give birth to a butterfly. And what is the appropriate response to vermin, to cockroaches? Well, it's to eliminate them. We saw the same thing in this country. The president referring to migrants seeking legal asylum called them animals, said that their presence among us was an infestation. Said Nancy Pelosi says, stop calling them animals. She's wrong. They are animals. They are animals. Well, what happens with animals? You put them in cages. You separate their offspring and don't return them. And starting 2.5 years ago, the public policy of the United States, as announced by the Attorney General, as enforced by the Secretaries of Homeland Security and Health and Human Services, and as triumphed by the president, was to take legally asylum-seeking migrants, put them in cages, separate them from their children. We have 5,000 children in this country who have not been reunited with their parents. Many of the parents have been sent back to where they came from. I believe that is a crime against humanity. We now have news accounts of some of those migrants having forced sterilizations, which is something else you do with animals. And so there are consequences of dehumanization that we need to take very, very seriously. So what can normal folks do about it? Number one, when you hear dehumanizing language, you can sound the alarm and say, hey, that's unacceptable. You cannot consider human beings to be less than human. The other is to hold leaders responsible for the consequences of their language. So in the book, I, for example, show a number of leaders who went over the line in demonizing and dehumanizing language. When they were called on it, they pulled back. So, for example, Senator John McCain and his running mate, Governor Sarah Palin, they had ads on the air saying that Obama, Senator Obama, launched his campaign from a terrorist's living room, that he palled around with terrorists. There was, at the time, the birther conspiracy saying that Obama was secretly Muslim and secretly Kenyan. What happened because of all of that is at rallies of Senator McCain, people would chant, Obama is a terrorist, kill Obama. The Secret Service deployed to investigate that. Well, that was too much for John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis of beloved memory. He held a public event and wrote a public letter to Senator McCain, and he said, Senator, you're a friend of mine. But what you are saying and what your campaign is doing is putting Senator Obama and his family at risk. You are using language that is reminiscent of George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, when I was beaten by the state troopers in Alabama. You are playing with fire, which is where the title of my book came
from. It's on fire.
You are playing with fire. And I call on you to stop. And if you do not stop, I will hold you accountable for any harm that comes to the Obamas. That's what civic leaders need to do. Colin Powell said essentially the same thing in the same week, and that caused Senator McCain to stop. To his credit, he stopped.
Stopped.
We saw something similar this past summer, and that is one of the patterns of dangerous language is the invention of an exaggerated crisis that requires mobilization of force. And during Black Lives Matter, a number of people, Black Lives Matter, by the way, 26 million people on the streets, the largest social movement in American history. But some people who are not Black Lives Matter adherents began to commit violence against property and even violence against police officers. That led the president to call for the mobilization of the active duty military in violation of the law. He even deployed the 82nd Airborne Division to Virginia and Maryland, and the troops were in combat gear with fixed bayonets on their automatic weapons about to be deployed into Washington, D.C. The Secretary of Defense held a conference call with the president and governors, and he said, don't worry, governors, don't worry, mayors. we, the U.S. military, will dominate the battle space that is American cities. And as soon as that happened, retired Secretary of Defense James Mattis, four-star Marine, went to the Atlantic magazine and he denounced Secretary Esper and he denounced President Trump. And he said, Mr. Secretary, what you were doing is both inappropriate and unconstitutional. It is dangerous. You cannot use the language of battle space to talk about American cities. You cannot say the U.S. military will dominate American cities. They will not. And I'm calling on you to stop that. Secretary Esper backed off.
Right.
Secretary Mattis then turned his attention to President Trump and said, Mr. President, in all of my time in the cabinet, I never once heard you use language to unite, only to divide. What you are proposing is unconstitutional and dangerous, and I will not allow you to do that. Secretary Mattis, as a four-star Marine, as a former member of the cabinet, had standing to say that, and the president actually took it seriously, and he stopped. He stopped that particular thing. He tried to find something else to replace it. But we see that at the macro level. We can do that at the level of the school board. We can do that at the level of the mayor. We can do that at the level of the basketball coach at school. When we see people dehumanizing, demeaning, and putting other people's lives and safety at risk, we can call attention to it. We can name it. We can say, I will not permit that, and I will hold you accountable for the consequence.
So unacceptable and accountable, extremely important. Take it to your local, take it to your personal, what's going on around you. Fred, what do you say to, you know, people will say, oh, this is politics. Things go on in campaigns. This has been happening for so long. Is it social media that is enlightening the average consumer, the average person to be privy to this, that we can all now have a voice and say unacceptable?
I would argue that it is not politics as usual, that we have never had a president who uses all 12 forms of language that have the consequence of causing people to take up arms against others. We saw, for example, when the president tweeted, liberate Michigan, and oh, by the way, protect our beloved Second Amendment. What do those two things have to do with each other? Armed militias went to the state capitol, and we saw last week that a number of them who had been at the state capitol in April, following the president's tweets, took the president's denunciation of the Michigan governor as inspiration to kidnap the governor, to put her on a show trial, and to hang her. Yeah. And the FBI thankfully disrupted that before the kidnapping took place.
Yes.
But that is a direct consequence of that kind of language that demonizes and dehumanizes a rival or a critic. When people say, well, this is just politics, I say, no, this isn't just politics. This is something more than politics. And we saw with Senator McCain that when called on it, he stopped. But the president has been called on it, and every single time he's called on it, he escalates. He intensifies. What I would say is, in the book, I say that the president is not the cause of this. The president is the consequence of this. That there are three trends that, in a kind of a braid, I believe have led us to this place. The first is the change in television news from primarily a public service role to an entertainment role. And that happened as family-owned news organizations became part of entertainment conglomerates.
So is this a switch from journalists to sort of opinion hosts?
It is a shift from the ratings don't matter to the ratings are everything.
Right.
And I even quote Don Hewitt, the inventor of 60 Minutes, who said back then nobody talked about ratings in television news. Today, everyone talks about ratings in television news. So I think it's the profit motive.
Well, even the president talks about ratings.
He talks about ratings of his own events on television. But that's one stream, is television has migrated from service to spectacle. The other stream is hyper-polarization of American politics, where compromise is seen as weakness. And that plays right into television as spectacle. The third is the decline in critical thinking skills among citizens. Mm. And I quote in the book the Roman Catholic economist and theologian Michael Novak, who says the first of all moral obligations is to think clearly. And we as a society have seen critical thinking diminish to the point where it's no longer taught in schools. to the point that there are some parts of the country where the political platform of the parties in power is to prevent the teaching of critical thinking skills in the schools. The Texas Republican Party platform of 2012 affirmatively says, we will not permit the teaching of critical thinking skills in our schools. Just think of the consequences of that. You put those three things together as a braid, and that's what I think has led us to this point. You add social media to the mix. You add the narrow casting. That social media is a lot like Netflix. You like this news story, you're going to like this news story, and pretty soon we're only seeing the things that we have self-selected.
You're in an echo chamber. Absolutely.
And my reality and your reality are two completely different realities. And what social media does is it intensifies that. I don't believe it is the cause of that braid. Right. That braid preceded social media. But social media intensifies it and makes it much harder to figure out what the truth is and what the truth is not.
Oh, absolutely. And just on the note of the critical thinking, being clear-minded and open, it's more difficult with all of the technology and what's out there on social media and all the dopamine hits that we're getting from our social networks to step back and to really think clearly. So social media sort of adds to that dynamic as well.
And then if you add the bots that replicate that in just extraordinary volume in a very small amount of time, we see people being bombarded with false information, and then they begin to believe it.
Right.
So you may have noticed in the last couple of weeks, Cornell University's Alliance for Science published a study about misinformation around COVID. And it looked at 1.1 million stories, news stories in English, between January and the end of May. And it said that 37% of the 1.1 million stories that had misinformation was attributed to the president. And about 50% was probably sourced to the president because people would hear what the president said, repeat it without naming him. And of all of the forms of misinformation about COVID, the one that was the most prevalent, 380,000 stories, was about miracle cures like hydroxychloroquine.
Oh my goodness.
Or like injecting disinfectants into your body. The second, with about 50,000 stories, was about COVID is really a deep state plot to discredit the president. The third is that COVID isn't real, it's a Democratic Party hoax, 40,000 stories. So people hear that. It gets amplified on social media. They begin to behave in ways that are dangerous to themselves and to others. So, for example, after the Woodward tapes revealed that the president knew in February that COVID is airborne, that it's deadly, that it's five times more deadly than the flu, the president intentionally downplayed that, spoke the opposite, and his followers believed it. So even after that tape was revealed, even after that tape was public, the president held a rally in Michigan. CNN arrived and noticed nobody wearing masks. And he asked them, why aren't you wearing a mask? And they said, because COVID is a hoax. And that is the tangible consequence of language that is used to mislead. But people hear the language and they act on it. And because they were bombarded on social media, it's a hoax, it's a hoax, it's a hoax, it's a hoax. When they're out in public, they don't wear the mask. When they're asked why not, because it's a hoax.
Right.
We know it's not a hoax. 217,000 Americans have already died of it. 7.5 million Americans have contracted the disease. But the president continues to say, it's going to go away. I'm cured. He's not. That there are tangible consequences to leaders who use influence and followers who rely on the leader. And that's why we need to hold leaders accountable for dangerous language and for misinformation. That frankly, when I wrote the book, I could document dozens of people who had been killed as a consequence of the president's language. We now have 217,000 people. Columbia University's Pandemic Resource and Response Initiative has calculated that 150,000 of them would not have died if we'd simply followed CDC guidelines. but the president does not follow CDC guidelines, and he doesn't encourage it, and he's interfered with the CDC, and his followers believe what they hear him say, and they are contracting the disease in super spreader events. We saw the consequence at the White House. We now had Florida the other day with no masking. He's going to be doing a rally a day over the next week with no masking. And that is going to have profound public health consequences.
Exactly. Fred, what do you think about generationally? So we have millennials in the workplace, Gen Z in college. I know that, I mean, just from my own research, that they care about empathy, that empathy is very important, and they want to see empathy from their leaders. So how do you think that younger generations, will they be able to confront the incendiary language?
Well, the good news is younger generations not only care about empathy, but they also care about each other. And I happen to have grown kids in that generation, and I study them carefully. Most of my graduate students are in that generation, and I admire them greatly. They're going to do great things in the world. The world that they are inheriting is a different world than the ones that, at least, that I inherited. And I'm a baby boomer. I remember when we were the young generation. I remember when we baby boomers were the rock and rolls. I grew up with the Beatles. I grew up with rock and roll music. And they said, you're a hippie, that you know, you're worthless, you're no good. And I said, no, we're not hippies. We just like rock and roll music. and you know, here I am now, an old fogey in my 60s, but I still feel that spark of youth that I felt in the early 70s.
Well, we feel your spark too.
but I so admire this new generation, because they're not only very well informed, but they are also, they approach life differently than we did, or at least than I did. I won't speak for others. They approach life with a curiosity, but also with a sense of boundaries, that they have a work-life balance that, yes, I never had.
And they don't live to work.
Right. And I joke that I have to find the proper work balance in my life.
Yeah, me too.
But my kids, to their credit, say, no, it's time for me to unplug. It's time for me to go and do something fun. And they're no less productive. In fact, in many ways, they're even more productive. Yeah. Because
they can have critical thinking because they're detached.
Right. And they have found a way to enforce that balance. And I at least grew up unable to enforce that balance, and it worked for me, but it doesn't mean that that's the only way to do these things. The other thing about this generation is this generation grew up where there are equal marriage rights for gay couples. They grew up where there's apparently greater and greater access to opportunity for immigrants, for people of color, for women in the workplace. And my generation grew up where that was really controversial. And for this generation, it's just a given. Well, of course we all have equal rights. Of course we all should have equivalent opportunities. And that's one of the things that's very inspiring, is this generation didn't grow up with those enforced divisions to the degree that my generation at least did. The idea of women working when I was in high school was just anathema. But these days, I couldn't imagine a world in which my daughters didn't have exactly the same opportunities as if I had sons they would have. But that's not the world that I grew up in.
Exactly. Well, we're looking forward to this fresh set of eyes and this youthful thinking to move us forward, definitely. What about just some parting advice, Fred, to round it all out, to let the Women Worldwide audience know what they can do, how their words matter?
Words have power, and that power can be used to call out the better angels of our nature, but it could also be used to call out the worst demon within us. And we need to be deeply intentional in the words we use so that we don't inadvertently call out someone's worst demons. But we also need to be attentive to the consequences of other people's language. And to the degree that we witness dehumanization, that we witness demonization, that we witness people being put in a position where just their very existence is a threat to somebody else, we need to step in and say, no, not on my watch. We won't let you do that. And the more we do that, the more we hold leaders accountable, the more the pendulum can swing back towards civility, back towards decency. We've gone way too far in the other direction. And I'm confident that in the coming decade, we will be back to decency and back to civility, but it has to be intentional.
Absolutely. Fred, excellent advice. Not on my watch. Words to remember and all of that. This is not acceptable, and accountability. Thank you so much for sharing your journey, for your thoughts, your book, and all that you're doing. And thanks for coming on the show. We appreciate you.
Thanks so much.
And thank you to all of you for tuning into Women Worldwide, wherever you are. Please keep sharing your feedback and letting us know how you are. If you'd like to get Women Worldwide updates, you can sign up on our website, womenworldwideshow.com. And of course, reach out to me anytime. You know how to find me. I'm on Twitter. I'm at Dee Breckenridge. Okay, friends, until our next episode, please be well, stay focused, safe, and energized.